This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Bourne.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Genius Loki, writing real-world places in speculative fiction.
So I feel it's worth mentioning that this week's episode was inspired by a small trip that Jules came down to see me in Winchester. If any of you have ever been to Winchester, it's an incredibly historical city. And it's also the home of many legends, mostly because of its historical past as the capital of Wessex, is it?
Yeah, it was the capital of the Old Kingdom of Wessex and the seat of Anglo-Saxon rule up until, you know, the Normans came along.
So a cool place to be.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And, you know, if you're like me and you're interested in all the different layers of history, and particularly in Britain, it's something you see Tudor buildings next to 17th century buildings, next to old black and white houses, next to bits that are much, much older than Tudor. And it's very particular around sort of the Wiltshire, Dorset, Somerset type area as well. You do have these layers and layers of history. And I think places like that have a genius loci, a spirit of the place themselves. All these layers of history have gone into making something what it is. And writers who like to use real world places, the really, really good ones seem to capture that spirit of the place, or at least, you know, an element of it in their writing.
And I think you can mark usually quite clearly whether somebody has actually been to the place that they're talking about or whether they haven't.
You can. There are people who their research has been so exquisitely done and so carefully woven into what they've done that people have congratulated them on visiting places that they haven't actually been to, but they've written about.
Yep.
But in general, most people have visited, you know, if it's realistic. Otherwise, it's quite surfacey.
Yeah.
Is that even a word, surfacey?
Well, it is now. But yeah, otherwise, it does feel quite superficial. So we're going to be looking at a few examples of where writers have really managed to capture the spirit of a place in their writing, a real world place, and where they haven't managed quite so much.
Yeah.
And we're going to focus on the British Isles for the moment, but we probably will branch out as well and mention a few other places around the world. Now, in particular, there is, because of England's very, very long history, you know, and the amount of times we've been invaded, we've got a lot of different sort of mythology popping up all over the place, mostly because we would go around and steal other people's mythology and bring it back home with us. So we've got a lot of it. There's a lot of it around. But when people say Celtic, which is a really suspicious word, ah, yes, the Celts. Who were the Celts?
Yes.
When people say Celtic mythology, we have a lot of sites which we kind of pair up with Celtic mythology, you know, not least including Stonehenge, places in Glastonbury. And these actually tend to be the most prominent places, real life places that pop up in speculative fiction based in a Celtic-esque world.
Including, you know, Avebury Circle, Mornbury Rings, Maiden Castle, which are all mostly Dorset based. A lot of those sites are way, way pre-Celtic, as in they're really not sure quite how old they are. The Celtic peoples, I mean, there were lots of different tribes from lots of different places, and most of them have come from other areas of Europe and then interbred with the Brittany people who lived here before that, and even they may have come in on ships themselves. And they made use of the sacred sites because, you know, why build a church when you've got one that's there already, kind of thing. So they would have used them in their own way. Genuinely, as I said, you get these sort of this layered effect of history going on and on. I mean, now, if you take the most famous example, Stonehenge, it's used by the Society of Bards, Ovids and Druids, and they do have actual permission to go up and touch the stones and use it for ritual, particular Sabbats of the year, so summer solstice and the winter solstice, and I think probably Beltane and Samhain as well, but I'm not absolutely sure. But you know, they did actually win a court case whereby they were allowed to go and touch the stones because basically got fenced off. I think it was sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, because people
People
going up to
kept
them and
chipping them off.
chipping off bits of the henge stones and taking them away, and damage was being done to them, so people can't actually go all the way up to Stonehenge now. So there you go. Obviously, if you've got the modern day druids, as it were, using the site, what they're practicing is going to be completely different to what the, I'll say, original druids
Yeah.
and the people who predated the original druids would have possibly used the stone circle for.
And yet you see Stonehenge popping up in a lot of places because it has these connections and is a perception attached to it. We see it pop up a lot in speculative fiction. And I'm pretty sure there was an old Merlin movie at one point, an Arthurian legend movie. Or it might even have been Robin Hood. There was something like in the past. And yeah, someone just went to Stonehenge and was hanging out there and just sort of called upon dark spirits or something along those lines. And interestingly enough, Stonehenge is one of these interesting ones where at this point we're not sure whether the essence of Stonehenge is what inspires the writing or the writing is what inspires the essence of Stonehenge now for us as a modern audience.
It's so entangled in its own mythology and the fact that it is now rightly shorthand for a particular type of mystical movement that it's really difficult to separate out the actual place, as it were, from
Yeah.
its reproduction in fiction.
Another one we see a lot of are certain castles that appear. Castles and places of worship. Now, there's places in Bath which pop up a lot, but also prominent castles. And when we're talking about prominent castles, we start to veer more towards Renaissance castles in England, so things like Hampton Court, and other Tudor castles, really. And then, as we start to go north, or as we start to go west towards Scotland, Scotland north, obviously, west to Ireland, you start to get castle much older castles that do appear again and again in speculative fiction. And these are real places, which again, like Stonehenge, but not quite as much as Stonehenge, are trapped in their own mythology, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to forget, obviously, the Tower of London, one of the most famous castles of all. And people think that the Tower of London is just a tower, and actually it's not at all. It's a
No.
huge, huge castle with many, many different buildings, and it is about 1200 years old, if not a little bit older than that. There are definitely parts of it that date back to sort of 900 AD.
Yeah. Now the Tower of London has been used particularly in a lot of prominent work to do with ghosts and ghost stories. I'm trying to. I had a book and it's gone completely out of my mind. Have you got any on you can name, Jules?
On the Tower of London, not specifically. And the thing is, it's another one of those that it's so sunk into our sort of cultural zeitgeist that, I mean, if you were to say the Bloody Tower, probably people would know that you meant the Tower of London.
Yeah,
And
yes.
it is, again, so many different layers of history. It's obviously, I think it's been used in lots of different Tudor books and things like that,
Yeah.
because that seems to be the time period people think of. And of course, they think of the two princes in the tower, so Richard
They
of
do.
York as well.
But interestingly enough, if we look at fiction which is actually based in an alternative universe, which is kind of like draws on elements of our own world, you will see particular landmarks which appear in both. And these landmarks don't actually tend to be the modern landmarks that we have, such as the London Eye or you know, modern buildings. They are old buildings, such as the Tower of London, such as the Bath Springs, such as Stonehenge. They appear in other dimension works. Where whilst modern architecture doesn't, and they tend to have the same kind of roles that they do in our in our world and in our historical fiction, basically.
Yeah, they are map markers. So you only have to compare a map from the 1700s with a map of the same area from today to see how vastly different it is. And if you get a series of maps, it's quite fascinating to look at. But these really old sites act as locators.
There was the Bartimaeus trilogy. Did you ever read that, Jules?
That's not the... Is that the Amulet of Samarkand?
Yeah. That one.
I think I might have read the first one, but it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Jonathan Stroud.
Yes, that's correct, yeah. I just remember it as Bartimaeus because I just thought that was the best name ever. just thought Bartimaeus was a cool name. but that was set in a kind of steampunk alternative London as well.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? I'm not imagining that.
No. From what I remember, I mean, this is a long time ago and I only read the first one, but yes, it was.
And again, it managed to capture that same feeling, even though it was vastly different. I felt like he did actually capture a certain essence about London. Dynamicism that is London. Now, I think we could have an entire episode on London itself. I am personally not a fan of London. I don't like it. It's too crowded. It smells... I don't like London, okay?
Yeah.
It's too big, it's too crowded, there's too much noise, it's like a constant barrage. And yet, at the same time, I can appreciate London for what it is. And London, again, because of its history, is this hub of energy. And it's incredible, because at one point, London wasn't just the capital of England. It was a capital of a humongous empire that stretched across the globe.
Yep.
And because of that, it had so much traffic going through it. We had, again, this is why I always laugh whenever you have something set in sort of Victorian London and all the characters are white, and I'm like, guys, Victorian London was so multicultural. You wouldn't believe, you had a lot of Indian people, you had a whole ton of Chinese people coming in. It was so multicultural, and it has kept that essence. It's really kept that feeling that London remains this hub of culture, of ideas, and even though there are parts of London that I despise, and it's ridiculously expensive, and all of that, you know, negative things that are starting to happen in London at the moment, you cannot get rid of that spirit that comes, and it's a spirit that goes beyond just being a city. I've been in other cities, you know. London is unique.
Yeah.
And if you can capture that, you can capture that spirit of London, managing to balance how despicably awful it is by how kind of amazing it is at the same time. Finding that balance, it really requires somebody who has experience in London.
Yeah, and to be fair, London is at least 2,000 years old, if not older. There's been some settlement there for, you know, two millennia and a bit more, because it was obviously Londinium during the Roman era. And yeah. Then when the Romans pretty much abandoned Britain, London Vic was set up sort of away from the original Roman site, but in the same sort of area. And that's around the time that Westminster was created. So it all becomes part of it. And again, you have this stacking effect of history, so you don't have to create the entire beast that is London, because that would be a complete behemoth that would take over in the novel. But you can take bits of it. Robin Jarvis does a pretty good job of this with the Deptford Mice, and it's mostly set around Deptford and the Greenwich Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And also with his Weird Museum trilogy, and you get to see bits of London at different times. So it basically the premise behind those books are that the three fates from Nordic mythology are aging and keep a tiny museum in the back streets of London, and they need a way to make sure that the last root of the world tree, Yggdrasil, carries on. And they can create portals that sort of drill backwards through time, so you get to see all sorts of bits of London. And back, the main character ends up getting sent back to the Second World War.
That's fun.
in the middle of a bombing, which is not great for him.
No.
But he also gets sent back to other parts of Victorian London when the museum itself was used as an asylum, and there was this nasty character who stalked the wards and tortured the inmates and things like that. It's a genuinely quite creepy book. But it captures the spirit of the place during those different eras really, really well.
Speaking of Victorian London, we do have a lot of stuff set around Victorian London because of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
And again, we could have an entire episode about serial killers.
Maybe we should.
Jack the Ripper didn't kill that many people. I mean, he killed them horrifically, but he didn't kill that many people. But he's captured the imagination and the terror of a lot of people, considering. And he's famous. Whitechapel is famous because of it.
Now, we're
sort of moving a little bit away from speculative fiction here. When I talk about Ripper Street, I don't know if you've ever watched Ripper Street.
I keep meaning to.
Goodness, it's brilliant. It's got Matthew McFadden in it. I have a small thing about Matthew McFadden. I just think he's brilliant. Ever since I watched him as Prior Philip.
I can understand that.
Pillars of the Earth. But yeah, so Ripper Street is based around Whitechapel after the Ripper has finished up. And people and lives going on after that. And to me, it perfectly encapsulates Victorian London and London in general, the whole London feel, in that it manages to feel modern without actually being modern. Now, London is not actually that historical as a city. We don't have, if you compare London to Paris, okay, for instance, Paris is filled with a lot of very old buildings. London doesn't actually comparatively have that many, and simply because London got bombed to hell, basically.
Yeah.
Paris was not destroyed in the same way, because Paris was a very beautiful city, and when the Germans were ordered to bomb Paris, to blow Paris up, I think it was a general basically said, oh yeah, it's bombing, Paris is burning, and he didn't do it because he couldn't stand. They'd lost the war, and he looked out over Paris, and he couldn't do it. So Paris is is really historical, a lot of buildings, whereas London is mostly modern, actually. We do have a few of these old buildings left, but it doesn't have that many. So when you watch Ripper Street, you're seeing all this old stuff, which isn't there anymore, because it got bombed a few decades later.
To be fair, like the old black and whites, the 17th century houses that had white plaster and the black timbers that are just so iconic of, you know, British architecture of that era, that's generally not there. There's a lot of Georgian buildings still there. There's a lot of Victorian in places that are still there, and most of it is modern. And it is because we've had a series of disasters. Obviously, we had the massive outbreak of the Black Death, followed by the Spicer's Row fire that swept out most of London.
Yeah.
So that got rid of a fair bit of it as well. And as you say, the bombing in the Second World War. So
basically, I mean, London has been torn apart and rebuilt back up over and over again. So it does have these odd little historical spots, but in general, actually, it's not that old as a city, building-wise. So watching Ripper Street, it should have felt foreign in some ways, because it had all this stuff that we absolutely don't have anymore in London. And yet, the spirit of London was there, and there was absolutely no doubt that they were in London. There was one bit in one of the series which really, to me, demonstrated an understanding of London as a place, the spirit of London. And it was that Edmund Reed, the main character, leaves at one point. He sort of quits the police, he's done his thing, he goes off. And then he returns to Whitechapel. And they talk about the fact that the city made him who he was. And to me, that small sentence, and it sounds very cheesy, but to me that small sentence really demonstrates a full understanding of Londoners and of the city itself, which is that if you are born of London, if London is where you belong, you can never really leave it. Like, at least not easily.
Yeah.
And I think that's even more demonstrated by the fact that my father keeps insisting that I have to go and live in London at least once in my life. Because he lived there. I mean, he was born up north in Cheshire. But, you know, he lived there with my mom for a few years. And they loved it because there was always something to do. And so he keeps saying to my brother and me, yeah, you need to live in London at least once. And I'm like, yeah, with what money? Also, no. No one actually wants to live in London anymore. But that's obviously not true because Londoners cannot escape London. It becomes a part of you. It is almost onto itself, this very unique living organism. And what always amuses me is when American writers try to write London. And I think they imagine it's a little bit like New York in some ways. Or yeah. They imagine it's kind of got this very sort of British sort of upty feel to it, which always really makes me laugh.
Or it's Cockney.
Yeah. And
really,
I...
really old Cockney, not the developing Cockney that we've got now. And there's this essence that people who speak in a Cockney accent are a bit simple or, you know, they're street smart but not very intelligent. And actually, if you listen to proper Cockney rhyming slang, it's an art form. And if we'd walled off the East End of London for 50 years and then broken the wall down, we wouldn't be speaking the same language anymore. It's that intricate.
Yeah, it's very, very intricate. It's very smart. And it's a huge cultural thing as well. But I love it. I'm trying to think of an example. Supernatural. I'm not sure this is London. It's just England. Supernatural. at one point, they have this British character. It's London. They say London. And then it shows this. They show a picture of London Bridge. And I'm like, great, London. Okay, we know this is very clearly London now. So they got the slightly sort of blurry shot of London Bridge, and then they have a different shot of a car pulling up to this house, which is so obviously not in London, because it's this house, and the architecture is American idea of what English houses should be.
Yeah,
and it's just absolutely not the architecture that you find in London, like, at all. It's so blindingly obvious to anyone who's ever been to London that this is not in London. And yet, if you haven't been there, it would go completely over your head. And they go in, and the setup of the entire house on the inside, again, it doesn't feel like a London house. In fact, it doesn't feel like the setup of an English house at all, even though they've got all these traditional kind of things that you'd associate with old English houses, you know, panel floors, things up on the certain decoration up on the wall, fireplaces and stuff like that. But at the same time, the way it's been put together completely lacks any of the essence of anything you would ever find in London. And if you did find it in London, you'd find it in an American home. You wouldn't find it in a British one. And it was so jarring.
Part of it, I suppose, is also the layout of the two. If you want to play Tale of Two Cities with New York and London, New York is very, very young comparatively. It's built on a swampland originally, and it's layered out on a grid system. I managed to pretty much memorise the main part of New York when I was there, mm-hmm. just over 5 days, and I didn't, you know, I just memorised where I needed to go, and it's so easy to find your way around in New York. Whereas London, I would have to have a map with me just to check, even now. And yeah. I've got the London Underground memorised, so I know roughly where everything is.
Yeah, see, the Americans have definitely got something right in their grid system. Now, on the one side, it makes everything really boring. On the other side, it makes everything, you know, really super easy to find. So I appreciate that. London is nothing like that. In fact, most English cities are nothing like that because it's just... because they're so old, we kind of built something there, then thought, let's build something here as well. And they're totally nonsensical.
But I found the same thing with Tokyo and Kyoto, actually. They're both on a sort of grid system, so they were quite easy to navigate.
Yeah.
So it must just be us building things willy-nilly and letting them grow, like, without check over 2,000 years.
Well done, English folk. You've done it again.
Good planning. Actually, yeah. As a small example of really, really great English architecture and planning, the house I lived in when I was 16, 17 was about 4.5 centuries old. And one of the upstairs rooms, it was my sister's room. Clearly, they'd built the walls and thought about putting a door on afterwards. So what they'd done was they'd knocked out part of the wall so they could put in a fastening for the door. So you can quite clearly see the wall's been built, and then they've gone, hang on a minute, a door's got to go on here, and he hasn't left enough space. And it's like, that is what the typical old English home is like. The floorboards are uneven.
Guys, hold
Poor
on a
sack.
second. We built this room, but there's a problem.
How badly did you want a door on this room?
The thing is, I can almost imagine it that they were inside the room when they finished the wall and were like, great! Ah, right.
Yes.
Small problem, fellas. We've literally bricked ourselves in. So if you're an American writer trying to capture the English kind of essence of architecture and cities, think of something that makes no sense and you've probably got it. That's how we work, that's how we roll.
Yeah,
Also, we really like staircases, okay? Really, really like
big
staircases.
time. We like them almost as much as the Welsh like roundabouts in their road system. Very big on their Kesha.
That's another thing that American, every time the Americans, you've got an American TV show or an American book that goes to England, and you guys are obsessed with roundabouts because you don't have them in
No.
America. You don't really have roundabouts in America, do you?
No, I don't think they do.
I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like for an American person coming to the UK facing a roundabout for the first time. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, you're on the wrong side of the road for a start, aren't you? So that's not great.
So yeah, but I think that the last bit about London is how much it's misunderstood. And again, I think it's because it's compared either to New York or it's compared to the rest of what you assume Britain is like. And London is unto itself a very separate place, just like Paris is. And I'll talk about Paris in a minute, even though we're only supposed to be talking about the British Isles. But Paris is close enough.
Not for very
So,
long.
shush, we're not talking about the European Union. Don't get me started. So, London, I think it was occasionally, or long-running series based in America, they'll always have an episode where they come over to the UK. There's always one. They come over to the UK and it's the same jokes. They try and get into the wrong side of the car. They end up having tea time at the palace or somewhere established like that, and someone drives on the wrong side of the road or makes a turning that they're not supposed to. And somehow they're always fine. And it's especially the road turning where they make a turning that they're not supposed to, and a few horns blare and something like that. Let me tell you right now, if you take a wrong turning in London the way you're not supposed to, you will die. Like, first of all, traffic doesn't move that fast. Second of all, when it is moving, like, if you get in the way, you'll get killed. That's it. They're like, London traffic is onto itself a kind of, a death race.
Yeah, it's not as bad as, say, India, for example.
No.
We don't drive like complete madmen, but you don't want to get in the way of a London cabbie.
No, it because there's a bit of rage because it doesn't move, it doesn't move, it doesn't move. Suddenly it moves. Also, there's a lot of pedestrians and all that jazz. The other thing is that London is like sort of 80% made up of tourists there visiting London. I think most of the local London people are not around in the places you'd expect them to be because they know the better places to be in London.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Spirit of London, very different from what you'd expect. Now, spirit of Paris. Let's talk about Paris. So, when I say Paris to you, Jules, what do you think?
Well, I always think of catacombs, but that's because that was the bit that stayed with me. The other bits that stay with me, I'm not sure I should actually say out loud. Let's just say I accidentally went into a cafe wine bar in the red light area in Paris and got mistaken for a lady of the night. I can't imagine why with how I was dressed, but it's basically somewhere that, okay, I'm going to tell the story now since I'm halfway there.
Go on, go on.
I went with a friend and it was one of the bars, or cafe bars generally, where the better class of prostitute went to acquire wine before entertaining for the evening. And I think that generally women don't go into these cafes for some reason, unless they're acquiring wine to entertain somebody. And I went in being typical British tourist person and asked for a beer in my rather fledgling French. And in French they said, well, do you want a small or a medium? And I felt really outraged that they hadn't offered me a large beer because I thought I could handle a large beer. But when my medium beer came out, it was a 2.5 pint job. So I think they were playing a trick on me. I guess this, for my friend, who is male, a very, very dainty little glass of vodka with an umbrella appeared. And you could see them watching me get through this massive like beer krug for the quite strong beer. And when I stood up at the end and said thank you very much and goodbye again in my rather fledgling French, I actually got a round of applause from behind the bar. And I think by that point they decided I wasn't actually a prostitute. But it was only later when I was playing back some of the things I'd heard in French, but not fully understood at the time through my head, that I realised what they'd actually been saying about me.
Oh, that's perfect.
So
that's...
there you go. But it was quite a pleasant evening, apart from, you know, being mistaken for a lady of the night.
When we say Paris, a lot of people think of the city of love. And there's obviously, you see Paris and you think of, it's the city of love, and you've got the Eiffel Tower, and, you know, there's a guy riding a bicycle with a string of onions around his neck in a striped shirt and a beret and a mustache.
It's always sunset, isn't it, in these memories? And
yeah, it is.
The lights are just coming on. And
yeah. So, now,
unless you're me and you think of death and prostitution, apparently.
So Paris is this city of love, and, you know, I think it stems from all sorts of stuff. You've got the Moulin Rouge, okay, which paints this whole idea of, you know, the bohemian side of things. And I think the other reason Paris is the city of love is that because of the art and things that were coming through in certain parts of Paris, it has this very bohemian feel to it in certain parts that gives this huge romantic ideal, because you had all of these amazing people who died too young who did their greatest work in Paris, and because it's the home of a lot of beautiful art, and because it wasn't bombed too much, it has all this history. So Paris has this reputation of being the city of love, and every time I read about people talking about Paris and describing these beautiful, this romantic feel, I know they've never been to Paris. Because Paris is awful. It's a terrible place. It's a really, really terrible place. Let me tell you why Paris is a terrible place, okay? First of all, Parisians are rude.
Oh my God, yeah.
They're so rude, okay? Now, this is not me being, people go, oh, you just don't care about the French. No, I'm half French, okay? I'm half French. My mother lived in Versailles. I've been to Paris quite a lot. I hate it. I hate Paris. And most French people also hate Parisians. Parisians are onto themselves, their own little kind of species.
They're really quite snobby as well, I found.
Yeah, they are. They're quite snobby. Now, don't get me wrong. Different parts of Paris, you've got the different little boroughs, you've got different little areas. Versailles, I love Versailles. It's a beautiful part. You've got the palace. It's amazing. It doesn't actually feel like it's part of Paris. In fact, I wouldn't tend to class it as part of Paris. And you've definitely got the bohemian sides of Paris and the red light districts. And some of these are nicer to be in, depending who you are.
Yes.
But Paris is overcrowded. It's very dangerous. The crime is on the rise, very simply. And it stinks. Paris is a city that really does genuinely smell. I don't know if you've ever been... People complain about the English underground. Let me tell you, the French underground
is... It's nothing compared to that. And it really does reek. And it's not just the Seine either, because you obviously get a bit of the river smell off the Thames when the tide's in and when the tide's out, you can tell. But by comparison, it's like, oh my God, it's like weak old fish and something else.
There's something else. And also, there are certain parts of Paris where if you stand still, you can feel the ground shaking.
Yeah.
And it's because of the underground. Beneath your feet, you can actually feel it shaking beneath you. And I've always said, Paris is beautiful as long as you're looking up. You look up at the architecture, you do not look onto the street, you do not catch eyes with anybody else. Because it's incredibly ugly in that respect. And as I said, people are not genuinely very nice. Parisians are concerned with how many cigarettes they can get in between A to B as they walk from one direction to another. They power walk in a very distressing way. And yeah, not very, very polite. So Paris as the City of Love is an illusion created by people who've never really been to Paris. Now, that's not to say you haven't traveled to Paris. Like, that's lots of people go on romantic holidays to Paris and they do all the lovely little sights. But anytime I've read any kind of fiction where, oh yes, I've lived in Paris and oh, it's so wonderful, oh, it's so beautiful, and I'm like, no. Anyone who's lived in Paris will tell you, without a shadow of a doubt, that it is the pits.
And it's like, yeah, we went on they arrange a romantic getaway weekend to Paris. I'm like, why are you going to Paris? Honestly, can't think of anywhere less romantic.
It's not a very romantic place. I mean, Paris is the only city I've ever been into where they've got vending machines just out and about for condoms. Like, yep. How desperate do you have to be that you're like on the street like, oh Christ, I really need a condom right now. Like, no, guys, Paris, let's take a minute to think about this. So Paris does again appear in a lot of different fiction. I think it almost appears more than London does in some ways. And this is speculative fiction. Anastasia, right?
Yeah.
It was a great, great cartoon. So horrifically inaccurate, but, you know, fantastic cartoon. And it does count as speculative fiction because, you know, there was a talking bat and they were in hell and there was all sorts of magic stuff.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about, obviously, the lost Countess of she Romanov, wasn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah,
yeah. She was Romanov. Anyway, the Romanovs basically got wiped out, apart from, apparently, Anastasia, the lost Countess, no, Princess Anastasia. Anyway.
Who was definitely dead, guys. She was absolutely definitely dead. She did not survive. And they go to Paris, and they have this wonderful, beautiful time in Paris, and everything is dandy while they're there. And it's so inaccurate that it captures, and this is where Paris has onto itself two spirits. And it has the spirit of Paris as we see it from the outside and the spirit of Paris as it's seen on the inside. And they're complete polar opposites. And depending how you write, this is very important, because depending how you write, it might be totally appropriate for your character to see Paris as this wonderful romantic place if they're from the outside of Paris. But it doesn't work if you do it from the inside. And strangely enough, this brings us back to when we were talking about Stonehenge, and we were talking about the mysticism of Stonehenge and other iconic Celtic places across the British Isles, which is that if you approach it with the kind of the mythology which has been placed onto it by literature around it, that only really works if your character again is coming from the outside. If you are trying to write it from the inside, you need to have an experience not of fiction but of reality, which means that you have to go there and you have to communicate with the people who live there and see how they feel about it. And you'll tend to find that it has a very different sort of feel to it. Something which was mystical and had a kind of I can't even describe how this is, kind of feel yeah. to it. You know, this sort of overpowering sort of wow factor to it will actually tend to, even if it is seen as mystical by the locals, will tend to have more of a sinister feel to it from the local perspective, or a kind of a disregard, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's often a juxtaposition of mindsets. So I'm going to move us into the countryside a bit more and talk about books that I can just barely claim speculative fiction, really. But they have got a supernatural edge to them, even though it's never really explained. And that's Phil Rickman's Merrily Watkins series. Merrily Watkins is a vicar who becomes one of the Church of England's diocesan exorcists. A dying breed, but still, they're called deliverance ministers now. There's bad connotations with the word exorcist, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But what he does very well in every single one of his books is he talks about a place like Hereford and Hereford Cathedral and St. Thomas Cantilupe in the second book. He talks about the border country. Now, you can be a British native and not really understand border country. Border country is basically the bit quite near to where I live, actually, between England and Wales. And basically, over the centuries, the border between Wales and England has moved back and forth, depending on who was most in power. In general, it was mostly the English. But that bit in the middle has bred a type of people with a "we don't get involved, we sit on the fence" mindset, which was probably why they survived, because you sided with the Welsh and you got shot by the English, with arrows, obviously, not guns. Or you sided with the English and you got murdered by the Welsh. So if you played at being Switzerland, basically, in the middle, and traded with both sides but didn't favour either of them, you were just about okay. And what's really fascinating is the way he looks at this long strip of the countryside through Herefordshire and part of Gloucestershire, obviously, as well. There's two in particular I want to mention. I won't mention all 13 of his books because we don't have time for that. But there's The Prayer of the Night Shepherd. That's one of the more light books he's written, I've found. And he talks about Hergest Court, which is in the border country, just on the edge of Wales, just on the edge of England. And what's really interesting about Hergest Court is the fact that it's got a story of this demonic horse dog type thing appearing over the centuries to various people, actually in the church. In one story, it's actually a bull, but there's something sort of there in local legend that stayed there. It doesn't have a specific name, it's just sort of the black beast. And a person who stayed at Hergest Court was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Now, everyone thinks The Hound of Baskervilles is actually set in Dartmoor. In fact, Arthur Conan Doyle Society is absolutely dead certain it's set in Dartmoor. Whereas, by contrast, the Sherlock Holmes Society is absolutely certain Hound of the Baskervilles is actually set in border country in Wales, or just on the edge of Wales. And he certainly wrote the story Hound of the Baskervilles when he was staying in Hergest Court, or he wrote a good proportion of it. So that's very interesting, and that all gets worked into this book, The Prayer of the Night Shepherd. The other one I'll mention is a lot more local to me, and that's one of the three books that actually genuinely really freaked me out, and it's The Lamp of the Wicked. And it is set all around Gloucestershire area and the Forest of Dean, which we mentioned before the show. we won't go into that. And also, you know, just over the border. And it's incredibly easy to get from all these different places around here. They're really, really close together. And what links all these places together in this story is the legacy left behind by serial killer rapist Fred West and his wife. And it is a really, really freaky book, because there were so many potential copycat killers afterwards. Mm-hmm. And there's still, I think a couple of years ago, they found some bodies when they were excavating a field that had some of the telltale signs. So they may well have been either old victims that were never claimed or discovered, or it may have been the result of a copycat. There's a really horrible mindset. His house on Cromwell Road, I walked to work over Cromwell Road, literally over where the house stood, for ages without realizing that that was that house. I just hadn't made the connection. They tore the house down to stop people coming and taking souvenirs, and just paved over the whole thing, and nothing will get built there again. But it is incredibly disturbing the way it's all woven in, and it's woven in with the Gloucestershire myths and legends and things as well. And obviously this horrible legacy. I mean, without going into too much detail, I think it's treated quite sensitively, considering that the children of Fred and Rose West are still alive and probably do not want to be bothered with any of this.
Yeah.
It is still really, really interesting and very cleverly done that he's captured both the beauty of the Cotswolds and the Gloucestershire sort of countryside, and at the same time this horrible dark underbelly. And there is that sort of, there is in some areas that dark sort of mindset where we don't talk about these sort of things, but we know they're going on.
Yeah, and I think there is definitely not just in border country, but another aspect that often gets forgotten in writing is that the balance between finding the spirit of the environment itself, which you saw a lot again in The Hound of the Baskervilles. You saw that the environment was onto itself a little bit of a character. It's the balance between finding the character of the of the environment and the character of the people around it. And very often, you, whenever there's a horror story, you know, that they go to this creepy place, and all of the townspeople are really kind of unhelpful.
American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, why have you got a pentagram on the wall? Tis for the wolf. It's like, does it say wolf? I don't know. Not supposed to walk on the moor at night. And to be fair, I've shamelessly used that myself because it's just great. I used that in I Belong to the Earth, but expanded on it a bit.
I remember, this is a personal experience. I went to Lyme Regis with my partner, Sean. We went out there for a brief holiday in sort of the beginning of October last year, I think it was. It was the last sunny weekend before everything became drab and dreary. We got the bus into Lyme Regis from the train station, and we got off at the wrong stop, and we didn't actually know where to go because we didn't know where our hotel was. And the first thing, while we were on the bus, we were talking to the bus driver and saying, can you drop us off at this location because we don't know which stop it is. And there was a couple of people behind us who were a little bit odd, and they were like, oh, are you that? We know that stop, that's the one opposite the school. And we went, oh, okay. And they said, oh, but be careful, there are witches. And I thought, that's a very odd thing to say. And then they kind of looked at each other knowingly and didn't continue. And I was there like, okay, all right, that's a good start. So then we got off, and they buggered off. And then we were completely alone by this bus stop, and we didn't know which direction to walk in. So we just started walking. And of course, there was no signal. And Sean just looked around and he said, oh, we're in the middle of nowhere. And because I stood there like, yeah, but isn't it beautiful? And he was there like, yeah, but we're in the middle of nowhere and we've got no signal. And I stood there and I thought, this is the beginning of every horror film ever. Every weekend horror film where some locals have given us a cryptic message. We've gotten off the bus. The woman goes, isn't this beautiful? The man goes, we're in the middle of nowhere and neither of us have any signal. And I just thought, wow.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Lyme Regis and a lot of the villages dotted around that part of Dorset are a bit like that in the sort of helpfulness stakes. Very closed mouth to people from off.
Yeah, from who aren't from the area. And yet, so I was there like, is it going to be this kind of trip? Is this the kind of backward people we're gonna meet? And then, of course, it was nothing like that at all. We got into Lyme Regis, had a great time, and, you know, everyone was super, super duper friendly. So it was nothing like that. But I think the only series I've ever watched which has, to me, perfectly captured the mood of small, especially seaside villages in England was Broadchurch.
Yeah.
And again, this is not speculative fiction, but I'm going to mention it anyway, because to me, even though that was a fictional town, the feel of it was very in keeping with pretty much any kind of seaside village that you get across that coast. And they had to redo it in America. They redid it in America, and I watched the first American episode. And I guess maybe they redid it in America because actually the whole general feel of Broadchurch, and it's called Broadchurch because it's obviously based around the area, and that's what the city, the town is called. And the town, the atmosphere is almost a character itself with everything going on. And they had to change it. And I'm not sure whether they changed it because they just wanted an American version, or whether they thought that American people wouldn't understand or wouldn't appreciate not just the humour, but the kind of the feel of it. And I think that comparatively, when I compared the two, the difference was so vast. It was in tiny little details in the way they built up certain moods. And yet there was such a strong distinction, which really demonstrated to me how well Broadchurch, the English version, managed to capture the general mood of places like that, which is that you have these locals and they're all super duper friendly and they're all really open and everyone kind of knows each other's secrets, except when they don't know each other's secrets. And you get this small-mindedness in places and this kind of this loyalty in certain areas that you shouldn't have, shouldn't, where they shouldn't really be loyal. And it's little things like that which to me are the most honest portrayals of not just village life in that area, but actually village life in general in the UK, or yeah, not in the UK, at least in England.
I know, I think that saying the UK is actually pretty fair. I mean, you know, there's a sort of indulgent type feeling towards the tourists and that, but also it's almost like, well, you're children, you don't really know anything, you're grockles.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree.
So, we're coming to the end.
We are coming to the end. I'm just going to mention one place that I used, which mm-hmm. I think is probably lesser known, and I used it in book two of my Unveiled series, which is I Am Silence, and it's a place that I went to a lot. I mean, I Am Silence is actually set in the village that I grew up in, with a little, I've tweaked the distances a bit to make the storytelling a bit easier. So I've been a bit cheeky. And the other village where my parents actually live now, or rather just outside of it. And so it's all set around that area of Dorset. But the place I'm specifically thinking of, that's sort of, again, a presence in its own right, if I've done it correctly, is Bullbarrow, which is a 900 and something foot hill, a long barrow in Dorset. And it goes back to the Iron Age, if not a bit further. There's burial mounds up on the top there, and you can go up there, and it's either foggy and you can't see anything, or it's absolutely glorious and you can see pretty much all of what would have been the old Kingdom of Wessex in one direction and the rest of the Blackmoor Vale in the other direction. And it's absolutely stunning, and there's a feeling about the place that you don't really get anywhere else. I think everybody probably has somewhere that's their Bullbarrow, but that one is clearly mine.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously in the book, I've used that and used my own sort of feelings and experiences about the places.
Yeah.
And the benefit is, having grown up there and spent so many times climbing that hill, is the fact that I do know all the little bits that people wouldn't necessarily know, like the fact that there is a natural spring bubbling out the side of the hill and other bits and pieces like that. Exactly what it's like when the wind's howling through the burial mounds up there.
Yeah. And having read, I've got the advantage that I read I Am the Silence, and you do capture it beautifully. You know, I know Dorset only vaguely because I was in school around Shaftesbury, but I never really got to see much of Dorset itself. And yet I felt bodily all of the things that you were describing. I could really see it, and it felt organic and real. Now, me in contrast, I'm writing this series, I've mentioned it before, it's the Kestrel Saga. And that is actually, Kestrel lives in London. And this is a little a funny story, which is that Kestrel, her name is Kestrel McBurney. And I took McBurney from a friend of mine, Neve McBurney, who lives in London as well. And I discovered purely by chance that the place that I set Kestrel to live in, which I just chose sort of because it was convenient, is actually, funnily enough, where Neve McBurney now currently lives. So apparently, you know, I was shadowing that. But I've never actually lived in London because I don't want to, and I don't want to go near it. So I don't actually know London that well. And yet I decided to set Kestrel there. And even though she's now there and it suits for her to be there, it's incredibly difficult to write her there. And so I keep removing her from London and sending her to other places. So in the first book, she ends up in Horsham, which is where I live when I'm not in Winchester. It's where, you know, my family home is. And she pretty much ends up at my house in Horsham, going through St. Leonard's Forest, which again, I can totally describe. And I feel so much more confident building that up because I know the area, I know the whole feel of the place. And then when she's left Horsham, she ends up in Glastonbury, of course, and then Cheddar Gorge. And I went to school there again. I went to school in Somerset. I know Glastonbury very well. I know Cheddar Gorge very well. And it's just so much easier to put characters into places when you've had experience of those places. That's not to say you can't put them elsewhere. You can break your back doing a lot of research if you want to, which is what I do whenever she's in London. But there has to be something said for writing what you know. And I'm not going to go too much into the whole writing what you know thing, because you don't have to write what you know. You can play around with stuff. But when it comes to capturing the spirit of a place, nothing beats visiting there first and snooping around.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, you can do meticulous research, and some people do it to the extent where you can't tell that they haven't been there. But, you know, it's a lot of backbreaking work, as in years. There's a trilogy I'm writing that's set in Song Dynasty China, and I basically started researching it for, I researched it for 5 years before I started writing it. So, because I've never been to China, I've certainly never been to that part of China. That just shows you how much yeah. extra effort you might need to do if you can't get to a place.
And if in doubt, you can always you can always contact somebody who does know the area.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, secondhand experience is better than none. Well, on that note,
I think that's it for today.
Well, thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed, and we'll catch you up next week.
Yeah, thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.